be telling you about random averaging, and this is work that was done with my collaborator Paul Kopiewski. I also touched a little bit the work done with John Marta, and I talked to Paul about this. I said, what are you going to talk in LA? I said, I have no idea. I think I'm going to give a crazy talk. So as far as I'm concerned, this is really an agglomeration of things that that were, in my mind, belong together. But I have the feeling I'm going to do my best effort to confuse you. And the reason is because, you know, over the past several years, I've been working about what happened when you take numbers and average them. And what's confusing is that in some cases you're averaging the velocities of particles, and in some cases you're averaging actually orientation of needles or microtubules. In some cases they are, there's the worst case of all, you're averaging the opinions of people. So those are the various pieces, and so here I'll, in 1 and 3 I'll be talking actually about the averaging velocities of billiard balls. In this case I'll talk about averaging opinions. And in this case, averaging maybe a phase or something with a chiral symmetry. So the themes of what I'll talk about, there are several themes that will come up. And one is the notion of scaling and multi-scaling, which I think most people will be familiar with. Another one is the notion of cascades that we hear maybe about in fluids. Pattern formation and bifurcation, so maybe this is my weak attempt at trying to connect with shapes. And a phase transition and synchronization. Okay, part one, averaging. So it's a very simple process where you have n numbers, and those n numbers live in a box, so there's no spatial dimensionality. And in each step, every one of those particles carries a number, which I'll call a velocity in this case. And you pick two of those numbers, and you average them, and you put them back in the box. So really, you can think about it as a collision between two grains or between two billiard balls or whatever. And this collision in the high school physics terminology is an inelastic collision or perfectly inelastic collision. But really what happens, because momentum is conserved, is that the sum of the velocities is conserved throughout the collision. There's momentum conservation. We have another conservation law, which is conservation of the number of particles, but there's also a dissipation. The energy is dissipated. So here it is, we have two particles that this in velocity space, they sit in different position, but after they interact, they sit in the same position. And that's it. And those interactions are always in pairs.
And yeah. How do you select the pairs?
Randomly. Completely randomly.
Independent of spatial location?
There's no spatial location. Well, no they live in that wonderful okay. box. But there is, it's independent, more important, of velocity. Because if those were really particles, what you would want actually, if those were really billiard balls, you might want to select them with relative rates V1 minus V2 average, the rate by which they're approaching there. It's like, think about two highway and two cars approaching each other. The rate of approach is V1 minus V2. If V1 equals V2, there is no interaction. So it's an idealist model. But we're in good company because that model was introduced by Maxwell to actually derive the Maxwellian distribution. For real particles in a gas. So he did that. It, since you asked, it turns out that if particles interact with 1 over r to the fourth potential, this is there's a physics behind picking them completely randomly. So it's called the Maxwell model. Okay, so conservation law and dissipation. The total number of particles is conserved. That means that we have 2 particles and we put back 2 particles. The total momentum is conserved, some vi is a constant. Energy is half vi squared, I'll assume that the mass is 1. And the energy dissipated in each encounter, here it is. This is the amount of energy dissipated. Every collision dissipates energy.
But after some collision has occurred, then the masses are different. So you don't take that into account when...
No, those are perfect billiard balls. They collide, there's restitution, and
You have 2 particles in the same quote-unquote location. When that particle undergoes a collision, does it have twice as much mass or not?
No, let me explain again the model, because obviously I didn't explain it well. There's a box. In that box, there are n numbers. There are velocities, okay? 1, 2, 7, 4.2. You take 2 particles, yeah? One particle has velocity 3, the other one has velocity 1. And after the collision, both particles have velocity 2. So the total momentum before of those two particles was four, and after that was four.
So you don't identify the two particles?
You don't.
Okay. No, okay. They're all indistinguishable. But they, you know, the particles have an identity. I was three, after the collision I'm two. Okay, so you know, if I lose you here, then might as well leave the room and go lunch, so please ask me a question. So because of this, we expect the velocities to constantly shrink. Really, the energy is dissipated. We keep doing this, the energy is dissipated. Let's say that the average velocity of particle is zero. Now, I'll do a bunch of things that we physicists like to do. One is that there will be a dynamic treatment, there will be a notion of time, which is not really necessary, but it's useful. So time will basically encode how many collisions on average particles underwent. So if the particles overall, on average, went two collisions per particle, then we'll call time t equal to. The interactions are random, as you asked, perfectly random. We'll also take the infinite particle limit. This is implicit in everything I will say. And also this is Galilean invariance, if you wish, or V goes to V plus V zero. So you can easily set the average velocity of particle to zero. There's no problem with that. Okay, so you can ask how hot is this gas of particles? And the way to measure the hotness is to measure the temperature, which is the average energy. And you see, I'll show the next slide why, but it decays exponentially fast. It's very simple. And there's a constant called lambda. And basically, there's a trivial steady state. All energy is eventually dissipated from the system. Okay. The question is, how does the system approach the steady state? And the way you track it by looking, for example, at the moments. And what we have is the kinetic theory. We have to integrate over all the incoming velocity. So we have two particles, V1, PV1, V2, DV2, PV2. And then we have a gain term. We gain the average, and we lose the original particle. That's it. That's the kinetic theory. Okay, but it is nonlinear. Okay, so that's a way, and we think about, this is really an exact equation in the limit of an infinite number of particles. We can measure the moments of the distribution, and just for simplicity, it's a good idea to say that the average is average. The total number of particles will normalize to one. We can do that. And I'll take it to be symmetric so that all the odd moments vanish. So PV is equal to P minus V, and that will be preserved throughout the evolution. We can do that. Okay, so if I multiply this side by V to the n and this side by V to the n, there's a simple nonlinear equation for the moments, how they evolve. And there are two pieces. I mean, in fact, I could have put this piece to the right-hand side, but I chose it to put here, separated. Because, say, the fourth moment, so the fourth moment you'll have four and lambda 4 and 4, and here you'll have things like m2. And it turns out that asymptotically this convolution term is irrelevant, and those two terms dominate, and what you get is exponential decay of all the moments. So this is, and I'll show why. The reason you can show a little identity that lambda n is lambda m plus lambda n minus m. And therefore, if this is e minus lambda m, you can see immediately that this is subdominant. And really what we have is a multi-scaling spectrum of exponent. So every moment decays with the same identity. There's what we call multi-scaling of these moments. Okay? So, you know, the first moment decays, you know, the second moment indicates, it decays e minus t over 2, the fourth moment e minus t to the times 3 over 8, and so on. There's all kinds of numbers that show up here. Okay? So we have multi-scaling. And this multiscaling is characterized by a nonlinear spectrum of decay constant. Here it is. You can see that when n equals 1, you know, this reflects the conservation of lambda 0, lambda 1 equals 0. And this is concave. And it's saturated. It goes eventually to 1, the spectrum. And what is multiscaling tells you, for example, you can state it in many ways, but one way to state it is that if I know the third moment and the fourth moment behavior, I really don't know the seventh moment behavior. I have to calculate this lambda 7. To understand how the seventh moment decays. That's all. And when I talk here, I'm implicitly worrying about what happened when very, very large time, when all those numbers are really small. However, this is, if you look at the moments, it's all closed. You can get really exact. You can solve for the first moment, second moment, exactly. Get everything that you want to know exactly. You can mislead yourself to say that there is really there is no characteristic scale of the of this velocity or energy of particle. In fact, there is. And the way to see that is to look at the closed equations for the Fourier transform. This is the equation, again, since the Fourier transform is the generating function of the moments. So obviously the Fourier transform also should have a closed equation. Here's this equation, and it turns out that this equation admits a similarity solution. Let's go over this. And the similarity solution, the scale that underlies the similarity solution is exactly the temperature for the second moment. It's on the fourth moment and on the third. It's exactly the temperature. So we can scale the Fourier component K by basically square root of the temperature. And that constant will be the decay constant of the temperature divided by 2 lambda 2 over 2, which turns out to be a quarter. You plug this similarity ansatz here. So just a comment. What I'm solving here is the limit of very, very large time. It's asymptotic solution. I don't have an exact solution for this for every time, but I have for sort of speak time goes to infinity. And I get this nonlinear equation, which miraculously we could solve. It was just by inspection you could solve it. And maybe a hint is that if I take this term out, there is a solution which is E minus Z. This is all we modified it, okay? And there's some boundary condition that F of zero, and you solve it, okay? Once you solve it, you can actually invert it, and what you get is a squared Lorentzian, a squared Cauchy distribution. This is an exact solution for the scaling. So what happens is that you start with the distribution at early time, which is red hot, and then it cools down, and it's sort of cool blue. So the velocities are very small. So basically, this will happen if you take a bucket of sand and you agitate it, but then stop agitating it, it will just come to rest. Basically, all the energy goes away. And you see there's a parallel tail. And this is really, this parallel tail is what's responsible for the multiscaling, because you have to integrate up to some point, and then all moments beyond, the third will be divergent. So knowledge of the second moment is not enough to know the fourth moment or higher order moments. It's because of this divergence. So it's sort of, things now make sense. So temperature is the characteristic velocity scale. And multiscaling is a consequence of diverging moments of the parallel similarity function. Okay, but then there is another quirk in the story, because as I told you, there are stationary solutions. So there are solutions that correspond sort of to lambda equals zero. And I can solve this equation again with the right boundary condition. It's an exponential solution with an arbitrary V0. So for any velocity scale, there is a stationary solution, which is a Cauchy distribution or Lorentz. And this is just a statement, the convolution of two such distribution. Again, it's invariant. So how can a stationary solution be consistent with energy dissipation? There's something a little strange here, which took us a little bit time to understand. And the answer, I think, as you alluded with your gesture, is right here, is that we have a divergent energy. It's also, and there'll be another slide, next slide, I'll show you more about this. But just, it's kind of nice to solve this, get this number. This number two, you can get it with no work, and let me do that. I think it's quite instructive. There's a cascade process here. And let's just worry about very, very energetic particles. So when you have an energetic particle impinges on a very slow particle, well, you can just might as well forget what the velocity of the small particle is. It's irrelevant. So if you have a particle with a million collides with a particle of velocity 10, what you have is 2.5 million particles. And this is this picture here. And you can write the evolution equation for this linear process now, which I think actually sort of in the physical world is a lot stronger than what we have. This Boltzmann equation, which assumes factorizing distribution. And you get the parallel distribution just by equating those two sides of the equation. The only solution is V minus 2. And the reason there's a 4, there's one sort of from the transformation of V goes to V over 2, and another factor of 2 because we have generated two particles. So we have a cascade. One particle generates two energetic particles, those two generate 4, and so on. So the key for this is that there is a divergent energy and divergent dissipation scale. We have sort of a thought experiment of how to do this with billiard ball. Will be to shoot a very energetic billiard ball into a bunch of static billiard ball and see how its energy cascades. And it's sort of we use a terminology from fluid. So you pump energy here, the very, very powerful injection, which are rare, this energy cascades down as the particle dissipate energy, and it sort of evaporates. And this is, you know, this is a cartoon for a parallel distribution. And that's how we did this Monte Carlo, to understand this, is we said, well, we can do two things. We can let these guys cool forever, but that's not very interesting. Or we can actually artificially maintain temperature. So we think about it as almost as taxation. You have collisions that are taxing, and you have the Minister of Finance who collects the tax, but then decide to give it to one person. And that one person then, you know, interacts with other people, and this maintains
public government.
Yeah. So that's how it this power law behavior can be consistent, and you can maintain this, and so there's actually some physics. And also what's really interesting about this is that I wrote here that there are a whole family of solutions. For every V0, there's a solution. Well, it turns out that if you give it to one rich person, you will get one V0, and if you do another mechanism, there's a selection. And there's an infinite number of ways to do this, and the way that you implement this, you will get a different scale, which is the typical scale of most people. So it really depends how you pump the energy back into your economy. It really affects the sort of the richness of poor people. And the reason I'm using this econophysics is because this model was really redone in the context of money and interaction between people and social dynamics to describe the so-called Pareto distribution. Benoit, is this? It's called Pareto distribution that is observed in some quarters and in some situations.
In this situation, for income.
For income, for example. Or for, you know, somebody, sorry about the distribution in Egypt of territory or agricultural community of other territory which is fragmented. So this is really, there's a lot of work that has been done into this parallel distribution. So just to conclude, this moments exhibit multiscaling, distribution is self-similar, we have a parallel tail, we have stationary solution with infinite energy, driven steady states, and we have energy cascade. So restricted averaging. So I made the transition, we'll see how it goes into talking about opinions. And this is a model, again, introduced in France called the compromise process. And the idea is the following, is that you have to, now, not velocity anymore, it's opinion. You have two people of two different opinions. And what they do is they do exactly, if they're very, very close, they talk, they quickly reach sort of a consensus. So one person is of opinion 4.2 and I'm opinion 4.4. We talk and we both decide on the opinion 4.3. So this is the left, this is the right, whatever you want. However, if we sit down and we, you know, one person of opinion 7 and another person of opinion 5.9, and it's beyond the threshold that I can set to be 1 without loss of generality, then they say, I really don't like you. And they talk and talk and talk, and doesn't matter how much they drink. They just stay the same position. They're frustrated with each other. So there is an attempt in this model to mimic the sort of balance between compromise and conviction. I'm willing to compromise, but only up to a point. And I have a conviction, so I have some pride. So I don't know if you like this model, but one thing I can tell you is that in one parameter, which is the initial spread of opinions, it will tell us everything. I will pick now one initial distribution. I can start with all kinds of initial distributions of opinion. I'll pick one because this is what the people who invented this model did. I'll pick one distribution which will be perfectly uniform. And this is the first simple. I say, let's say everybody, there's just as many people with that opinion, but then there's no people beyond some opinion. What is the final distribution? Well, without doing any mathematics, we know that there is a multitude or an infinite number of steady states. If I will put 20% of people with one opinion and another 20% with another opinion and another 60% with another opinion, and the separation between those parties or clusters is bigger than one, nothing happens. The people that talk to themselves, they're happy, but there will be no evolution. So this is the multiple, and in fact, you'll see, I will do simulations now. I can't solve it. I'm lost now as far as analytics solving this problem.
But the ability to set this up depends on delta.
Yes. Yeah. That was the only control parameter, the initial spread of opinion in the population. So if delta is smaller than one, we know that we've already solved the problem. All right, here's the problem, is that now I have to take this equation and put the restriction that I only integrate over people with sufficiently, okay. And now the key is that some theory is useful, because if you will try and do this with Monte Carlo simulation, which was what was done originally, you're going to go nowhere, and I'll show you why. Because as far as the computer is much happy integrating this equation, and this is what happens. What happens if you start with a flat distribution, there is a perturbation or descent or unhappy, I don't know what to call it, that creates the boundary. So we start with a flat distribution between, say, minus, say, in this case, 5 and plus 5. And this is a disturbance. This disturbance grows exponentially and grows. And by the time it's done with our society, we have four parties. Two left parties and two right parties. And I created this society to be symmetric, so the outcome is symmetric. But let's now, the fun begins. Is that, here's a question. I mean, take a society. Do you know if there exists a central party in a society? I don't know. I mean, some political systems have a central party and some don't. I mean, this is just an observation. Well, this model mimics that reality. So if we start with delta between 0 and 1.871, well, there is a central party. If delta is between those two numbers, there are two off-center parties, just by symmetry. Central party died, gone. So it's kind of neat already. Central party may or may not exist. Now, if delta, you increase it, you crank it further, there are now two off-center parties, left and right, but there's also a central party. And if you keep going on, there is two left parties and two right parties. So parties may or may not be equal in size. Those are delta functions, so don't pay too much attention to their heights. I mean, because obviously I have to tell you what the area under those. And it's very important, because the area is this MI, okay? Well, there's a slide that disappeared with our central party. But let me tell you that say delta is 2.2. What you see that there's a central party. There's a subtle feature here. There's a central party with mass 2.2. Everybody. But then if you look carefully, there are two tiny parties with something like 10 minus 3 of the people. They're here. So if you plot on a log scale, you're not going to see it. But if you plot on a linear scale, you're not going to see it. But so this is the slide that's missing, is that if delta is, say, there are two tiny parties, the subtle effects, there are fringe parties that you can create.
But do those vanish in the thermodynamic limit or not?
No.
This
is perfectly thermodynamic. In fact, if I take
this is numerical integration.
Yeah, this is also consistent with Monte Carlo. But with here, I can tell you with confidence that I know this number. If you start with a billion people, there'll be a million people in the fringe party and a billion people in the central party. It's perfectly thermodynamic. All right, and here it is. Here's the story. What we have is a series of bifurcation and patterns. This is delta, and here every time there's a party, there's a dot. So let's say we look at the delta of 10, 8, there's that many parties. 1, 2, 3, okay. Now, one thing we can really understand is the central party. We have seen that the central party exists, ceases to exist, resurrects itself, and so on and so forth. But those things are coupled. Whenever the central party dies, then it splits into two left and right. And then those live forever. And then again, it dies away, it nucleates those. There are three types of bifurcations. And there are color coding here, red and blue. Red are the fringe parties, or those 10 to the minus 3 size party, and blue are sort of, you know, the fraction of the population, say half of the population, a finest fraction of the a substantial fraction. Okay. With, as I said, a periodic sequence of bifurcation, the nucleation of the minor cluster branch, which happens right here. This is bifurcation type 1. There's bifurcation type 2, which is the nucleation of major cluster branch. This is type 2 right here, this one. And then there's bifurcation type 3, which is re-emergence of the central party. Okay. and they repeat themselves, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. Obviously, this is a pattern formation problem. There are patterns, as you saw, I'll come back to it. The clusters are equally spaced, and the spacing is bigger than two, is bigger than one. It's something like 1.1. It's twice this number. So the spacing between this party and this party is 2.155, between this one and this one is 1.08, okay? And that's the key, because we have two numbers in this problem, one, which I put the cutoff artificially, and then there's another number, say 1.08. 1 minus 1.08 is 0.08, that's sort of 0.1, that's a small number. That small number is responsible for this small number. And now this is just as a joke, is I don't know how many Israeli or Ukrainians, but there's several, it is very funny. If you look at the frequency of parties in the universe, then there's sort of a big, it's a bimodal distribution, and most countries are in this range with a standard deviation of 3, around an average of 6, but then there's another bump. Don't take it too seriously, because when I look, I would say that only 15% of the countries in this diagram are democratic, so. All right, so this is the cluster masses. It's periodic, as you can see, again with the same period. This number most important in this problem, 2.15, is the period. This is the growth of the central party. It splits into two. So those are major. Then there is minor parties that you have to probe on a logarithmic scale, and it's quite a remarkable thing, because there's a saturation mass of about 10 to the minus 4. This is the number you asked about. So 10 to the minus 4 of the people end up in fringe parties. This also, the central party, when it resurrects itself, it starts as a marginal creature. It again starts with 10 to the minus 4 of the people. But very quickly, it somehow makes a sharp transition into a major entity. So obviously, those transition, all those things are continuous. I'll talk about it in a second, but there are power law behavior here and so on. I'll show it. But the amazing thing, there are, even with our sophisticated integration, there are some subtle features that I cannot come here and tell you with certainty, but I know what's going on. There appear to be gaps where the minor party here, just right here, just dies away and resurrects itself, and it's at the level of 10 to the minus 10, where I just can't, you know, you need some other level of numerical sophistication to handle this. But one thing we do know is that this behavior is a power law. One, two, all those behaviors are power law, and the same thing with this behavior. And there are different powers. So the mass of those minor party vanishes as some power law near the transition, the verification point, right here. So right here, the way that this mass vanishes is a power law. And right here, the way that the mass increases is also a power law. And those powers are 3 and 4, respectively. And we have some excuse for this 10 to the minus 4. This excuse is that L minus 2 is a small parameter, and it explains the small saturation mass. Here's an explanation in a clean case when you go from a one-party system to a one-party, but plus two, it's a cartoon, fringe parties. What happens is that you can do a perturbation theory, and says let this interval length be 1 plus epsilon. You know that the central part, just by symmetry, the central part mass will be at around 0. And then you know that those parties will end up at basically 1 plus epsilon over 2. And what happens is that those parties, they really suffer from a problem, because this is like a big gravitational pull. It just pulls membership from them. And it pulls membership at the following rate. It's just exponential decay. But then we go back to this problem we've already solved. At the second moment, we know what's the sort of extension, how broad this, how diverse this party is. And when the difference between the diversity of this party and this location sort of become comparable, then the center here cannot longer talk to those guys, and the process stops. So you can use this argumentation to come up with an epsilon to the cube mass, final mass for this. You can use the same logic to argue why the other exponent is 4, because you're pulled by two sides. It's the same argument. Probably it's a lot sleazier. This is a slightly cleaner. So as I mentioned, this is really a pattern formation problem, and it took me a long time to understand that. And I sort of got some lessons in pattern formation from experts. tell me what you should look at. There are two types of ways to try and estimate this all-important number, 2.155. One way is to say that you start with a flat distribution, and you make a little perturbation to it, and you see what's the fastest growing mode. And you get this, you just look at this dispersion, you look at the maxima, and you do that. But there's something a lot more interesting happens when, as I show you, those perturbation that goes at the boundary and propagate to the bulk. This is what they look like. And you can find exactly what's the wave number of those. This is the number. You can find it exactly by doing sort of a saddle point analysis in a complex plane. It's basically a generalization of Fisher, Kolmogorov, Petrovsky, Piskunov selection, but you have to do it on the complex plane. Basically, this is the selection curve. You take this function and you do this, and you get this number. Unfortunately, the number that's selected by the dynamics is neither this nor that. It's somewhere exactly in between. And it's truly some intrinsically nonlinear mechanism that governs the pattern. And I don't know how to derive that. So this is really a very interesting problem, how to derive this pattern that's selected. So to conclude, is that our clusters form via Sierra a series of bifurcation. They have a periodic structure. And also, they have an alternating major-minor pattern. I like this, the fact that the central party does not always exist, and there are parallel behavior near transition, as we expect, and there's a truly nonlinear pattern selection mechanism. So diffusing averaging. So as I'm going back to granular materials and grains and variables, that's not too confusing, is that we have those particles, and with this cascade feature, I already said that, you know, already to keep these grains in motion, you have to keep shaking them. Think about a bucket of sand or billiard balls, and if you don't do anything, they just sit there because they lose energy. What you have to do is keep shaking those particles, and that's how our experiments are done, really. You have to keep pumping energy, and this pumping is one way that's easily experimentally accessible is basically to do it via a box. It's through the boundaries of the system. So it's, if you wish, it's an analog of the air particle in this room, but with the whole room shaking. But the air particles, they are elastic. Our granular particles are inelastic and are dissipative. So what you do is, in order, you add basically a white noise to this process. So there are two things that happen simultaneously and independently. One thing is what we've already talked about, which is taking two velocities and average them. And the other thing is that, well, you might take only one particle and give it a little nudge in a random way, so it'd be perfect. White noise. So all we've done is take our, and now the system will no longer keep dissipating energy, but we'll have a steady state. There'll be a steady state distribution of energy, of particle velocity, and so on. All we really need to do is to take the Fourier equation and add a dk square or diffusive term to it. It's absolutely simple. Again, we're working in Fourier space. And now the system reaches a non-trivial steady state, and where the energy injection by collisions with the boundary of the room or the box, they balance the energy dissipation by collision. This is a non-equilibrium steady state. If you track elastic molecules, if I give you a movie of an experiment of elastic molecule, you can reverse time in this movie. If you have a CCD camera, you can reverse time, and you won't be able to tell which way time is going. It's a non-equilibrium process. But our process right here, you can absolutely tell which way time is going, because you know that after a collision, you lose energy. So there's no detailed balance in the system. It's preferably a non-equilibrium system. It's a non-equilibrium steady state. And it's very nice. The way we solve this equation is by taking this term and moving it to the right-hand side. And we keep doing that forever. Just we keep iterating this equation onto itself. And we get an infinite product solution. And this infinite product, the pole that's closest to the real axis dominates. What we're really interested in is the large velocity behavior, the high energy tail of the distribution. And you see that we have an exponential tail rather than E minus V squared that you have in, say, a Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. So in this field, it had gotten the name overpopulated tail, overpopulated with respect to a Maxwellian. You can also get it just by balancing the major loss term with the diffusion term. You can also get the cumulative of the distribution by taking log of this equation and expanding 1 plus x, basically, as a log, log of 1 plus x is a Taylor series, and you get the cumulat exactly. And it's very nice because there is a relation between the cumulants, psi n, so second cumulant will be second moment minus first moment squared, and so on, those nice formulas. And there's a relation between the decay constant, say, of the nth cumulant or the nth moment, and those constant, those basically shaved moments, those where the cumulants are. And now it turns out that if you, you repeat everything I told you, but the particle don't have a one-dimensional velocity, but say a two-dimensional velocity, three-dimensional velocity, and you put the right collision rule, you can wonderfully match experiment. This is two experiments, one done by shaking a bunch of glass beads, shaking them very hard, and so hard that gravity is irrelevant at 60 g, or by shaking dust, sort of the magnetic dust. They both give you a universal distribution, which is remarkable. And this is the exponential tail I was talking about. And we can match that perfectly. What the experiment shows, we can also get things like the moments. And what's really subtle here is that the deviation for the Maxwell-Boltzmann is the blue line. The deviation occurred something like 10 minus 3 or 10 minus 4. It's a very subtle effect. And in fact, this is for highly dissipative particles. If I had particles that are weakly dissipative, this transition point where the departure, it can be arbitrarily small as I go to a small dissipation. So this you can think about shaken box of marbles. So to conclude, we have non-equilibrium steady state, and energy is pumped and dissipated by different mechanisms. We have overpopulation of high and tail with respect to the to equilibrium distribution. Last thing is orientational averaging. So let's not shake beads, but let's shake toothpicks. And this was really a model that was introduced by a colleague to try and understand how microtubules align themselves. I know nothing about the biology behind it. But here's the experiment that we did try to do in Los Alamos. And depending on the density of those toothpicks, which here are not toothpicks, but rather chains of granular particles, you can have a disorder, slightly disordered or quite nicely ordered. So this is our shaken digital toothpicks. And this is things that happen in liquid crystal. You have a transition from a nematic order to a disorder phase. And we basically repeat the same thing. It's again those rods, two rods, when they collide, they align perfectly. And they also wiggle a little bit. And we have this, again, we have to take this kinetic theory and add a diffusion term. And just the only thing that happens is that we have integration from minus pi to pi rather than minus infinity to infinity. But the fact that you do that now tells you that you have a discrete Fourier spectrum, and it obeys this closed equation. And again, we looked at the order parameter. I'm going to be obviously quick here. We have an order parameter, which is just the first Fourier mode. R equals 0 tells you a perfectly disordered state, and R equals 1, it's a perfectly ordered state. But you can also have partial ordering, where the order parameter is anything between 0 and 1. We can find that there's a critical diffusion constant. If you shake those toothpicks very hard, they're completely random. But if you shake them gently, they actually are partially aligned. And below, for diffusion less than critical diffusion, we have a partially ordered state. And when you shake them very, very hard, you have a perfectly disordered state. And the critical behavior is just like in Landau-Mean-Field theory. It's square root. This behavior here is square root. And those numbers here tells you how many Fourier modes you need to add in order to understand what's going on in the system. And it turned out that there's as little as 10 Fourier modes, which you can actually do on a piece of paper analytically. You can understand this transition. And this is what the distribution of orientation looks like. And here what I've done is, obviously this is symmetric. The rods can orient themselves to any angle. And all those are equivalent steady state. I subtracted the mean orientation to be zero. So this is what we have. We have above critical point, we have perfectly flat state. All orientation are equally likely. But then you can have that one orientation start dominating, and so on. And eventually, if I look at the very, very small diffusion, you have a delta function here. And that's in that case, this minus pi and pi limits are irrelevant.
But the Fourier mode, which is nice, they decay exponentially with the order parameter. And therefore, a small number of modes is sufficient to understand what's going on. So again, as I had before, our Fourier equation can be reiterated on itself an infinite number of times, or as many as you want. And what I've done here, he said, let's iterate it once. Let's just take this equation plug, so we'll take one of the, say, Pj, and resubstitute the equation. What I've done that is keep doing that as long as I don't have a 1. As long as j is not equal to 1, I will keep doing that. And what you end up is really with a diagram of partition of integers. So you have the equation, say, for the order parameter is all these things, is a series of r cubed, fifth, and so on. Of course, near the transition, I can forget of all the higher order term because r is very small. But in general, I have to keep all of them. And what this is a partition of the number 3, so this coefficient is partition number 3, according to center rule, certain rules that are implied in this equation. First is that k has to be I plus j, that's the partition. None of them should be 0. And the coupling constant between this Fourier mode and this Fourier mode should be non-zero. It turns out that the coupling between two more Fourier modes is 0 when the difference in the number between them is even. So the first Fourier mode and the third Fourier mode are not coupled. The first and the fifth are not coupled. The second and fourth, and so on. Other than that, they're all coupled. So it's a partition of integer with the special rules. And it can include minuses here. That's why the series is infinite. So this is our... And I'll just wrap up here. I wish I would have loved to tell you more about these partitions because it's really neat. But again, we have a non-equilibrium phase transition. In the weak noise, we have an ordered phase. And in the strong noise, we have a disordered phase. Solution relates to integer, iterated partition of integers. But maybe one thing I'd like to stress is that this whole averaging business, you asked me about what happened when there's a interaction rate between, say, two velocity, where there's a kernel in my Boltzmann equation. Well, generally, this Boltzmann equation, a lot of people are worried about it, but there's no analytic solutions of this equation. But in this case, when the spectrum is discrete, it turns out that this solution, the partition of integer, works for any it works for any interaction rate. I can have any kernel here. I can have, say, that rods that are perfectly aligned, they don't like to talk to each other, or whatever you want. This equation is perfectly solvable. So you can have here some k of phi, and this equation, so some really miracle happens. The Boltzmann equation with a discrete spectrum is exactly solvable. It's a series solution. It's not explicit, but it's definitely, there's no assumptions involved in it. Take it from. Yeah. You can do things that you can when you're talking about velocities, which go from minus, and then you have a continuous spectrum. So I think with that I'll end.